common language has always been a powerful tool. For millennia, it has tied together individuals into tribes, nations, and cultures. For millennia, it has helped people together define their world and refine their collective conceptions of what that world's parameters are. A common language is also the key to success at the point of care. Does the patient communicate their symptoms and healthcare goals effectively to their providers? Do the providers communicate their care decisions and the reasons for them effectively to the patients? How do we optimize the common language around health? Welcome to Steps to Value, a podcast that explores the intersection of people, process, and technology in healthcare as the industry moves towards a value-focused model. I'm your host, Rod Pihowski, and in today's episode, we'll talk to HIMSS 2016 Most Influential Woman in HIT Award winner, Marion Ball, about the common language needs of clinicians, patients, and developers towards a better experience at the point of care. All that and more coming up. If you're a high-achieving executive in a HIMSS-Davies award-winning or MRAM Stage 7 organization, you'll want to join your peers in the HIMSS Executive Institute. This community of leaders shares knowledge and experience to inform HIMSS initiatives like the MRAM, Davies 2.0, and the HIMSS Value Suite, and they come together to understand, achieve, and promote optimal value from the use of IT in a health setting. Learn more at hims.org/HEI.
Marion Ball is Senior Advisor, Research Industry Specialist, Healthcare Informatics at IBM Research. She is also Professor Emerita, Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. Marion is one of the winners of the HIMSS 2016 Most Influential Women in Health IT Award. Marion, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So how can solution providers be more effective when creating products that take into account nurses' natural workflow?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems that we have with technologists working with healthcare professionals is that they're taking it from their point of view, i.e. from a computer science point of view, a research mathematician or computer scientist, or even a health administrator's point of view, not realizing that they're trying to develop a tool that would enable the healthcare professional to do their work in their way, in the best possible way possible. So, not to involve the nurse or the physician or the pathologist or the researcher in developing and mastering how the technology can help them, not bringing them into the picture to help design the system is a big mistake. And I think this is what we're seeing a lot happening. We're seeing nurses are being told, you're going to use this particular hospital information system or drug information system, and this is the way you're going to do it. And it doesn't fit into their workflow. It doesn't fit into the way they practice their professions. And so, therefore, you're going to have a lot of failures. You're going to have a lot of workarounds. So the only way to solve that problem is to get the nurse, the physician, the social worker, to work with the technologists to develop the systems that will help them in their workflow, and that they are the ones that are telling the technologist what to develop for them, and not the developer of technology telling them what they think they should be using. So that will, of course, also require that the healthcare professional needs some training and education to be able to articulate well, to be able to explain what their needs are, to be able to do a flowchart maybe. So I think it's a matter of better communication between the two worlds, the vendor world and the practicing world.
And are you seeing any point of care solutions that take into account that communication, that are effectively driving clinical or financial or operational value?
Well, it's a great question, because that's my area of pet peeve, shall I say. How can we best serve the clinician at the point of care? So I've looked and have tried to explore all of the different kinds of technology? Should it be a cowl, the computers on wheels? Should it be an iPad? Should it be a laptop that you're carrying around with yourself? So what it comes down to is, if you look again at what do health professionals really need to do, they need to have their hands free to be able to care for the patient, to be able to communicate with the patient, to look the patient in the eye when they're talking with them, and not be drawn away by having to enter information on a keyboard or even turn their back to the patient to be able to make a change or pull down menu. So to answer the question directly, it's a technology that I saw that might at the moment still be a little bit too costly. But there was a very wonderful experimental project that was developed at UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Healthcare System, which was called the Smart Room. And the Smart Room was such that they developed a zone around the bed of where the patient was lying, which was an RFID, the radio frequency identification aspect. So when the caregiver or the dietitian or the phlebotomist would walk into that circle, which was around the patient's bed, the identification of that person would show up on the screen, like on their TV, and say, the phlebotomist has just walked in. They're going to take your blood. The patient can see. That's what they're going to do now. It says, this patient is latex intolerant. Aha. It's right there. There's nothing written. The phlebotomist is looking at the patient, is looking there, immediately knows they have to take off their blood, their gloves when they take the blood sample, because otherwise that patient could stay in the hospital for another 2 days because of their intolerance. That phlebotomist leaves, the next person that comes into, and as soon as they leave, the identification, which was on a little clip on the lapel, let's say, of the phlebotomist, and the wristband of the patient, which made a double identification. As soon as the person stepped out of the RFID zone, the lights went off, no problem with HIPAA, everything was secure. Next person who comes in is the dietitian, comes in with the tray for breakfast. Hi, Mrs. Jones, I'm ready to give you your breakfast. Looks up, and it says, this patient is NPO, this patient's going to be operated on today. So hands are on the tray, is looking up, it's all there, no keyboards, no nothing. The patient looks up and says, oh, I forgot, I don't have to eat breakfast today. The food isn't wasted. The dietitian steps out with the tray, and you've saved. So the idea being, the physician comes in, it tells me, this is Dr. Smith, he's going to take your blood pressure, then you can, and then the physician doesn't have to enter that he's going to do that. Everything is done by a wonderful RFID enabled visual contact with the patient. Again, to be able to free up the hands of the physician, the clinician, the nurse, the dietitian. That, to me, is the ultimate. That, in combination with voice activation, instead of now, well, he can see the blood pressure there and he can see the charting. Instead of now, he says, okay, or the nurse has to say, you know, I better just, I know I saw it, but I better write that down, which they do on your sleeve or on your dress or wherever. I can just speak into the system, push a button like we do on our cell phones if we want to send a message rather than type it in, and just say blood pressure was 120 over 80, okay, and walk out. It's all documented. Same thing for nurses, that they can speak into their laptops, into their nursing stations, rather than sitting all day looking at the keyboard and serving the computer instead of the computer serving the healthcare professional.
You mentioned workarounds, and workarounds always indicate or often indicate usability concerns. Obviously, health IT usability is a factor in terms of patient safety. How do you see future clinicians being taught about the impact that health IT can potentially have on the safety of their patients?
Well, obviously, patient safety is what it's all about. We're in a world now of looking at patient-centered care and all of the people who have an influence on that patient, from the doctor on down to the social worker, everybody who is in any way involved with that patient. So the whole aspect is, how do I keep that patient safe, which is your question. And we're trying to see what are the enabling technologies that enable us to provide a safer care plan for that particular patient. Now, it's wonderful that we have technology. There's no doubt that having an electronic health record, there's no doubt that having barcoding for drug administration, there are so many technologies that we can really say have worked towards trying to improve the safety. What we also need to realize, it's like a yin and a yang. All of a sudden, we're also realizing through the technology, we're introducing a whole new set of patient safety errors and mistakes. So that could be even worse than not having had the technology at all. So we still have a long ways to go. There are benefits, and we're seeing and finally learning what the negatives are, but over time, with new developments, with new technologies, and realizing that we have a social factor and the whole idea of how do we entice the provider to feel comfortable and use the technology, because you can also sabotage it. You can see even in security, you know, they're angry. They can destroy the piece of equipment physically because it's annoyed them. I've seen that happen. You take your wood, take wow. A girl, take off her shoe and with a heel, you know, say, this thing is just not working and they're making me do this and I'm going to quit my job. I mean, so you realize you're working with human beings. So it's a whole new world that we're developing. We were talking a little bit earlier about the importance of education and training. So to be able to maximize what the enabling technologies could do to make it a safer environment, we need to integrate the training into nursing schools, into medical schools, dental schools, all of the professional schools, so that the technology truly becomes an enabler and not a detriment to the patient. So the patient safety issue is really a balance right now. We need to be sure that we're making it safer and try and work and learn what are the downsides of the iatrogenic aspects of medicine, where you're introducing new errors which could be very, very harmful. So it's something that we're working towards. I don't think we're there yet, but the first aspect is realizing what the issues are. And as Max Planck said when he got the Nobel Prize in physics and changed the whole world of physics, the press asked him, Dr. Planck, little fellow, little German man, saying, how did you ever come to this fantastic revelation that changed the whole way in the world of physics? And he said, in the correct formulation of the question lies the key to the answer. So I think we're at the brink of starting to ask the right questions, and hopefully that will bring us to solve the problem of providing the best possible safe environment for the patient.
Are there any educational resources that you would recommend folks check out to speak to some of the concerns you just spoke about?
Well, the whole aspect of how do we train the next generation and the opportunities that are available. We're very fortunate that the National Library of Medicine, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, and my prejudice, I think it's the jewel in the crown of the National Institutes of Health, because it's the only worldwide medical library and that only specializes in healthcare. And there are many universities that have informatics departments where physicians not only can use their medical skills and advance their training and get a second specialty degree in informatics. And only within the last 2 to 3 years can you be a board-certified informatician, just like you would be a board-certified pediatrician or obstetrician or internist. So the training programs that are available through the National Library of Medicine have been existing now for almost 20 years. So that's one funding resource that universities are using, and There are even professional organizations. The American College of Medical Informatics is the creme de la creme of people who are the thought leaders. And then the American Medical Informatics Association, which is about, I would say, 6,000 to 7,000 people belong to that. And then, of course, you've got this fabulous organization here, HIMSS, with 40,000+ people. But there's always a component of education. And 10 years ago, or 11, 12 years ago now, the emphasis was much on medical education, which is fine. But if you think about who are the main caregivers in this world of our healthcare world, shall I say, in the U.S. or mostly around the world, it's the nurses. We've got over 3 million nurses in this country. They are the ones that see the patient 24/7. The physician will see the patient 10 minutes here, half an hour there at the most, or when they're doing a major procedure. So what are we doing to provide the education that is needed by the allied health professionals, nurses being the very biggest group? That 12 years ago, we established, and I'm very proud to be one of the founding members of the TIGER initiative. And even on my badge, you know, I'm a member of TIGER. TIGER, T-I-G-E-R, stands for Technology, Informatics, Guiding Education Reform. And it started out with the nursing profession to show them, you know, what we need to do from a social science point of view, from a technical point of view, from a human factors point of view, from a safety point of view, all of the points that you've made, and that the nursing profession has embraced that, and that now we've expanded the aspects of the TIGER initiative, which 3 years ago became part of the HIMSS organization, and HIMSS has been very much involved in education and training, and as you know, gives all kinds of certification in various aspects of educational knowledge. So we're very proud of the fact that the TIGER initiative now has gone viral and national and global, so that it's not only in 35 countries around the world, all, I must say, at the with the help of the wonderful support that TIGER has gotten from HIMSS, but I think even more important, it is now not just for nurses, but it's become interprofessional, so that we're looking at dietitians, we're looking at dentists, we're looking at all of the therapists, everyone realizing that knowing much more about the enabling technologies with their vast infrastructure and possibilities that can make a better, safer environment for the patient is here to stay and needs to be pushed even further. So there you go.
So Marianne, one of the reasons we're here is to discuss your 2016 Most Influential Woman in Health IT Award. I'm wondering what your perspective is on the environment for women in the health IT sector. How has it changed since you first started in the industry? What challenges have been overcome? What challenges remain?
Well, I'm a good person to ask that question because at the many years, almost the over 40 years that I've been in the field, when I graduated from high school in the late 50s, I had, as a woman, there were mostly three choices that women had. They could become a teacher, they could become a nurse, or they could become a secretary. That was you know, just accepted. I mean, to think that women in those days, and not that there weren't a few that did, you know, would go into medicine and law, the genre was, you know, you're really going to get married and you're going to be home and you're going to take care of your children. You really don't need any further education. Well, fast forward 40 years, believe me, the world has changed. And the fabulous aspect now is that it's the world is completely open now for women. Women have never had the opportunities that they have had now. And they've aggressively moved into that field. Women who before might have just become math teachers now have PhDs in computer science. They're going in rockets up to the moon. They're doing fantastic things as physicians, as dentists. Now, if you go to medical school, over 50% of the class are women, over 60% in dental schools, pharmacists. They are, all, I would say, almost 100% equal to men. Still a little bit where we do see in the literature that there's some discrepancy in compensation, that women still get a little bit lesser salaries. But I think that glass ceiling has certainly been broken. And I mean, we had the keynote speaker just yesterday, CEO Ginni Rometty of IBM Corporation. I mean, she can stand shoulder to shoulder to any man you could put in her way. So I think we've made it. And it's all in my lifetime, so I feel very good about that. Thank you for asking the question. That's a great question.
Of course. You know, we've been speaking a lot about education. I'm wondering if you can share maybe a story about your first mentor and a great piece of advice that they gave you.
Well, I've been very lucky. I mean, I'm more lucky than anybody that could possibly be. First of all, I had incredible parents. My father was a physician. My mother was a corrector therapist. Both were very accomplished. Both of my parents were Olympians. They competed in the 1928 Olympics. My mother got a gold medal in the Olympics. My father and mother both were pilots. I mean, this was in the 30s and 40s. I mean, you know, so if parents like that, I mean, you know, we had a lot going for us. I have a wonderful brother, Peter, who is an orthopedic surgeon at Yale University. So they raised the two of us to be able to really conquer the world, even though both of us are immigrants. My parents had to leave Germany before the Second World War, went to South Africa. I was born in South Africa. When apartheid came to South Africa, they had to leave again. So we're fortunate that at age 10, I was able to come to this wonderful country, the United States, for which I thank God every day. I think that we're so fortunate to have the opportunities that both men and women were able to have in this generation that I'm talking to that's unequaled anywhere in the world. So I just think that I have been blessed with mentors, first with my parents, who said, you can do anything that you want to do. Then I married at age 18. I married a professor who's 16 years older than me. He took over, gave me the best advice ever. He also got me involved in saying, always work to your strength. Go to where your strengths are. Being a woman is not a negative. It's a positive. So when I was interested in doing things in informatics, when it just started, I mean, computing in my generation wasn't even a computer science department. When I went to college, you could be a math major. And I mean, I did. I got my bachelor's and a master's in differential equations, which certainly didn't do me any good anywhere along the line. But anyway, you know, you got there. Then I got my doctorate in medical education. But the bottom line is, he said, stay away from the doctors. Your strength, you're a woman, you work with the nurses. They're the ones who can really support you. You'll work your way up that way. He was absolutely right, because now it started with nursing. Now we do it for everybody. And I just have been blessed. So I really appreciate you inviting me to talk to you today, and I hope I've been able to answer the questions to your satisfaction.
Absolutely, Marion. It's been a wonderful conversation. Hope you have time for just one more question.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I don't want to welcome.
No, we very much appreciate the conversation. We ask this of all of our guests. This podcast really focuses on the relationship between technology and humans, and we're wondering, it doesn't have to be in healthcare, what's your favorite technological invention, and what impact do you think it had on our culture?
Well, I would say the telephone. I think the human voice, having and using that as the beginning phase, because that was already there, believe it or not, when I was starting out the telephone. But how that telephone has now morphed into an incredible iPhone, which you still call it an iPhone, but actually it's not. It's a platform. It's a camera. It's an information base. You get all of your emails. You can see movies. It is an incredible technology. So to me, that is a game changer. And I would say the iPhone, or as they call it interestingly in German, which is an English word they use for it, they call it a handy. Everything you have is in your hand. So that would be the answer to that question.
Marion Ball, thank you so much for joining us today on Steps to Value.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
Hi, my name is John Daniels, Global Vice President for HIMSS Analytics. I bring value to HIMSS members by helping hospitals and clinics in their journey towards Stage 7 of the HIMSS Analytics Health IT Roadmaps. And you're listening to Steps to Value.
So how does your organization effectively communicate among its own tribes and cultures? Send us your thoughts as a voice memo or an email, and we'll play it or read it on the air at the end of our next episode. You can send your comments to value@hims.org. We'd like to thank our guest, Marion Ball, for sharing her perspective on the importance of a common language between patient, providers, and developers at the point of care. For more information on everything discussed by today's guest, please visit this episode's landing page at hims.org/steps-to-value. Steps to Value is a HIMSS North America production. The series is co-produced by Adam Baser. Kelly Lippitt is our guest relations manager, and I'm Rod Pihowski. See you next time on Steps to Value.